From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In April 1994, hell broke loose in Rwanda. In the space of 100 days, the country descended into a roaring genocide that left more than 800,000 Rwandans dead while the world looked away. There was no refuge but one, a lovely hotel in Rwanda's capital city that manager Paul Rusesabagina turned into a desperate sanctuary where, against all odds, 1,200 lives were saved. I know that hotel. A decade ago, I checked in and heard the stories of heroism and despair. Now, in the tradition of Schindler's List and The Killing Fields, Hollywood is bringing this story of courage to the world in the new film Hotel Rwanda. Tonight on Point, checking in to Hotel Rwanda with director Terry George and Paul Rusesabagina, the real-life hero at the heart of the story. You can join the conversation. Were you there? Was your family in Rwanda? Share your story. And with the killing going on today in Darfur, why does it take Hollywood to bring these nightmares to life, to the world, to shock us into understanding? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from NPR West in Los Angeles is Paul Rusesabagina, former manager of the Hotel Mille Collines in Kigali, Rwanda, during the 1994 Reign of Terror there. He saved the lives of more than 1,200 refugees. Don Cheadle plays him in the movie Hotel Rwanda. Paul Rusesabagina, thank you for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you very much.
And right next to him in the NPR studio is Terry George, director, writer, and producer of Hotel Rwanda. The movie's already opened in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. It begins its national rollout this weekend. Terry George made his directorial debut with Some Mother's Son and was nominated for an Academy Award for his first screenplay, In the Name of the Father. Terry George, welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Terry George, if I could turn to you first. We've got genocide going on right now, Colin Powell tells us, in the Sudan, in Darfur. This one is a decade old. What turned you to this story, the story of Rwanda?
Well, what turned me to it was the story of heroism of Paul and how this ordinary man took his skills as a hotelier, and used those to save all these people's lives, despite the fact that he had been abandoned by everyone, by the United Nations, by the Americans, by the West. And I first heard this story through an original script written by my co-writer, Keir Pearson. When I heard it, I was immediately attracted to it. I've been trying to write something about Africa, something that would say something about how ordinary Africans managed to survive in these cataclysmic wars that dotted the continent. And I felt that within Paul's story was the perfect opportunity to explain what goes on in Africa and at the same time produce a piece of entertainment that people would go and see.
And Paul Rusesabagina, I have to say, it was almost exactly 10 years ago, I guess 10 years ago this month, that I checked into the Hotel Mille Collines, Thousand Hills, I guess, the way that Rwanda is known for all of its hills. I came to follow up on what had happened in Rwanda and found that 8 months, nearly, 6 months at least, after the genocide had stopped, the country was still absolutely quivering with the horror of it. It lived in every street, and at your hotel, it was recounted to me again and again how people had survived by drinking water from the pool with just blood running in the streets all around. And here you are reliving it 10 years later. Is it like a nightmare to think back on it, or are you happy to see this film?
Well, it is a pleasure to see that at long last, 10 years later, people, the world can see what happened in Rwanda, and maybe this might help, as you said, to solve the problems of Sudan, what is happening in Darfur.
So if it can help somewhere else, there might be some good coming out of it. It's amazing how Hollywood brings it to life all these years later. I think for a lot of our listeners, the time's gone by, it might be worth looking back at exactly what happened. It was early in this month of April, 94, that the president of Rwanda's plane was shot down when he was about to come to he was pushing for peace accords between Hutu and Tutsi. Just the next day, Rwandan armed forces began the systematic killing of Tutsis and moderate Hutus. The UN did not intervene. Belgian peacekeepers killed. The next day, April 8th, the Tutsi Rwandan Patriotic Front, which had been based in Uganda, moved in to Rwanda to try and stop this. The next day, French, Belgians, Americans, civilians rescued by their governments, Rwandans not rescued, and then began came the slaughter, Terry George. Mm-hmm. I heard just story after story, very brutal, up close. Machetes and hoes and clubs, 800,000 at least dead.
Yeah, the slaughter, the sort of conception of the amount of killing and the physical brutality of it is mind-boggling. And as you say, Tom, as you travel around Rwanda, you hear individual stories of horror. But it became obvious to me when, having met Paul, learned the story, that my objective was to tell his story and allow the genocide, the political events and the events on the street to be a backdrop. And I never intended to replicate the genocide or try to tell the overall story or indeed recreate the horror, because I just didn't think it was possible in a feature film to do that. But at the same time, I wanted people to have the sense of how an ordinary person found the courage to survive and what it was like for an ordinary person like you and I to find themselves in the middle of that catastrophe.
We're going to listen to just a few clips from the film tonight as we talk along. Here's a bit early on when foreigners and Rwandans are being sorted out, four nationals permitted to leave the country, Rwandans not. In the middle of it all, Paul Rusesabagina.
Foreign nationals only. Sorry, Father, those were the orders.
But you can't leave the children behind.
Sorry, Father, we have our orders.
You can't leave them.
We can do no more.
Father,
no more.
It is of no use. These men are not here. They are not here to help us. Please, there is nothing we can do. Get your people on the bus. I will take care of the others. It is of no use, Father. Please, Paddy.
Get your people on the bus. Foreigners left. Rwandans didn't. Paul Rusesabagina, how on earth did you keep the armed forces that were promoting slaughter all over the country and right outside your hotel, how did you keep them from moving right in and killing that 1,200-plus people that ended up under your roof?
Well, I didn't ever keep them from coming in. They were always coming in and going out. They were visiting the hotel. You know, if you want to control someone, you keep him closer.
But on the outside, they were casually and systematically killing thousands. They must have seen the 1,000-plus that you had inside this hotel, including many who would have fallen into their target for death. How did you keep them at that close range from unleashing the same fury that was on the streets?
In order to keep them, I had to negotiate with them. I had also my own weapons. My weapons were some... first of all, my way of negotiating with them, talking, sitting down with them, convincing them, telling them, look here, one day all this will be over. Once it will be over, what will you do? And then you'll have to face history. And once you face history, what will you be your answer? So we had to negotiate, as I told you, and also when we negotiated around a glass of drink, that is a traditional way of negotiating. Mm. Yeah, and I also had a lot of contacts abroad. I had many people, I knew many people, many diplomats, many aid employees who were also in a way intervening. I also had Sabina. Sabina also was backing me in a way.
This is the Belgian company that owned your hotel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Terry George, most of our listeners will not yet have seen the film. It opened in L.A., Chicago, New York, mm-hmm. and I'm sure some have already, but many are still waiting for it to come. Give us a sense of how you portray what unfolded inside this fragile sanctuary that Paul created in the middle of Kigali.
Well, the story basically opens up with Paul working in the hotel, and, you know, Paul is a very modest man, even though he sits opposite me here and smiles when I say that. But he is and was the consummate hotelier. He knew how to get people what they wanted. He knew how to move them around and persuade them they didn't need things and to organize for them. And that was his skill, and he'd learned it over many years. And so He was a well-respected figure in Kigali and that community, with diplomats and with the local elite and so forth. And then on April 6th, he found himself in his home, the surrounded by the militia and the presidential guard, the Hutu army, and his neighbors, his Hutu moderate and Tutsi neighbors, fled to his house, some 32 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he then found himself in the position of trying to take them towards the hotel to find refuge. When he arrived, along the way, there were a series of incidents, all totally true, that were quite startling and also proved just Paul's ability to negotiate.
And is this the point in the film where he's essentially buying off the soldiers to keep them from killing his family and
yeah,
neighbors?
He was told by a Hutu captain to basically shoot his family and his Tutsi cockroaches, as they called them.
That was the term used on the radio to encourage the slaughter all over the country. Let's listen to that bit of the film where Paul Rusesa Bagina saves his family, a first step on the way to saving many more.
Here you are. See? This is enough for one cockroach. Pick one.
Sir, I will give you 100,000 francs. All of them.
Give me it.
I don't have it here. At the Mikolin, I can get it for you.
You'll run into the hotel and hide behind the UN.
Sir, I swear, 100,000 francs. I will get you the money. You keep them outside. Please, sir, please.
Let's go.
It's an absolutely chilling moment in Hotel Rwanda where Paul Rusesa Bagina manages to save his family and a small circle of neighbors and friends while the slaughter goes on all around. Paul, how close was it? We've seen the dramatic recreation. How close was it to disaster for you and your family? You were a Hutu, but your wife was Tutsi.
Well, it is. You mean how close it is to the movie?
How close did they come to death?
It was much harder than what you can see on the screen.
Mm.
Yeah, because what happened? You know, when I arrived from my house at about 1.5 kilometers, I was stopped by the captain, and then he asked me, "Listen, are you a manager?" "Yes," I said, "yes." "If you are a manager, all the managers of this country, you have killed them. You are the only one surviving. But you traitor, you are lucky. We are not killing you today because the government sent us to pick you up and bring you to the diplomat. But have a gun."
The diplomat, another hotel, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. "And kill all of your cockroaches here." Well, those cockroaches were my wife, my children, and my neighbors.
And he wanted you to do the killing?
Yes. He handed me over a gun and asked me to kill him. And you can imagine it took time because it was not easy. I faced him for about 5 minutes. And after facing him, when I watched him, I thought I would win against him. So I started negotiating.
And you pulled out money, and you pulled a ring off your finger, and you managed to get your family and some neighbors.
It was much longer than that. Mm. It was he started by asking 200,000 per person and per soldier, and there were 20 soldiers. So I started also telling him, "Listen, gentlemen, these people have got no money. I'm the only person who has got money. So let us go to the hotel. I will go to the safe. I get you what you want."
A real life and death negotiation at a moment when life had become horribly cheap in Rwanda. Paul Rusesa Bagina and Terry George, director of Hotel Rwanda, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the new film on Rwanda's last refuge in the genocide of 1994. You can join the conversation. Were you there? Was your family in Rwanda in the genocide? Did they survive? Tell us your story. And broader, does anything less than heroism stop genocide, even a tiny corner of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're checking into Hotel Rwanda tonight, the new film on Rwanda's last sanctuary in the genocide of 1994. You can join the conversation tonight. Why does it take Hollywood to bring this kind of nightmare fully to life, to shake us into understanding? And why does it take Schindler's List or The Killing Fields, The Pianist or Hotel Rwanda to wake us up too late? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. I'm joined tonight by Paul Rusesabagina, who was the real-life manager of the Hotel Mille Collines in Kigali, capital of Rwanda. In 1994, he managed to save the lives of more than 1,200 Rwandans and others in that nightmarish 100 days when more than 800,000 died. Also with us from NPR West in L.A. tonight, Terry George, director, writer, and producer of Hotel Rwanda. Here's a scene from the film when Paul has gathered the first of those who would join him inside the hotel. They're just beginning to take on board how dire the situation is, and he tells them there will not be any rescue.
There will be no rescue, no intervention force. We can only save ourselves. Many of you know influential people abroad. You must call these people. You must tell them what will happen to us.
Yes.
Say goodbye. But when you say goodbye, say it as though you are reaching through the phone and holding their hand. Let them know that if they let go of that hand, you will die. We must shame them into sending help.
And so the rescue begins. Terry George, I wonder if you actively saw this film in the Schindler's List and Killing Fields pianist genre. Is that the way you set out?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is nearly all of my career has been spent doing films similar to this, you know, In the Name of the Father and Some Mother's Son and Bright Shining Light, because I find that feature films have a unique way of conveying these historic events to people. You're able to take an audience inside the event and see it through either through Paul's eyes, through 360-degree turn. Just feel what it's like to be inside an event such as the Rwandan genocide or with the Killing Fields, the Cambodian genocide. And it's a unique way to engage audiences and hopefully let them experience something they don't get from news footage or even from documentary. So I find it very fulfilling at being able to tell a story in this way.
You put together a terrific cast for Hotel Rwanda. I wish you'd talk to us about how you put this crew together, how you chose Don Cheadle in the main role. Of course, seen him most recently in Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12, but all over the place. I mean, terrific actor. And Nick Nolte, Joaquin Phoenix, and right on down. How did you cast this?
Well, when I was writing this with Keir, I always pictured Don playing the role because I'd watched his career from Devil in a Blue Dress through, you know, Bullworth and Traffic, and he has this ability to disappear inside a role.
Yeah.
I talked to him and said, look, I'd love you to play this, but the first obligation is to get it made, and if, you know, if a studio wants to go with an A-list star, then I'll have to give that serious consideration. But
that
luckily,
is even bigger than Don Cheadle. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the Hollywood considers only two African-American actors capable of opening a picture. Now three, I guess.
You're talking about Morgan Freeman and Denzel Washington.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about Denzel Washington, Will Smith, and possibly Jamie Foxx.
Oh, okay.
But that's it. Mm-hmm. They never considered Don capable of opening the picture on his own. Luckily, we raised the money independently, and I was able to go back to him and say, okay, let's go. And then I had watched a British actress called Sophie Okonedo, who's actually Nigerian and Jewish.
And she plays Paul Rusesabagina's wife in the film.
Yeah, Tatiana. Mm-hmm. And she has similar qualities to Don in her ability to disappear into a role. Mm. She played a prostitute, a hooker, in Dirty Pretty Things. And if you saw the two movies, you wouldn't even recognize her between the both. So I felt, once I had them, I felt I've got the core of the whole story. And then after that, with the actors who were playing the white roles, it was basically an appeal to to my friends. And Nick Nolte contacted us and said he wanted to do it. He'd read the script.
And of course, he played essentially a character like Romeo Dallaire, the head of the UN forces there, who ended up in a kind of mind-bending frustration at the world's failure to come in and do anything.
Yeah, Nick's role is a composite of various UN officers who were there, who end up with basically hope, you know, they're in a hopeless position of ineffectual sort of total inability to do anything, despite the fact that they're soldiers.
Mm.
And I think Nick portrayed that wonderfully. And then Joaquin Phoenix, I showed him the role and asked him to do it, and he agreed right away.
As the photojournalist.
Yeah, and then we also had a fantastic group of South African actors who had come from they've a very strong soap opera television industry down there with wonderful actors, and I was able to cast many of them.
And you shot this in South Africa, not Rwanda. Why?
Well, we did. We shot for a week in Rwanda for some of the opening shots and so forth.
I saw that at the hotel.
Mm-hmm. But I felt that. First of all, the size of this film, that Rwanda didn't have the infrastructure to serve us, that we'd be able to bring it in on the time that we had, the short time that we had. And secondly, I was worried about the political temperature in Kigali then and now, that to recreate those events may have sparked memories and also incidents that we wouldn't be capable of controlling.
I think that a very worthy concern. Let's hear just a moment from the film Hotel Rwanda. This is where the photojournalist, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is talking with Don Cheadle, who plays the hotel manager, Paul Rusesabagina's role. He's taken pictures of the horrific killing that's going on. He shows them to the hotel manager, who says he expects that, of course, that will lead surely to international intervention.
Sorry about earlier. If I'd known you were in there, I wouldn't have...
I am glad that you have shot this footage and that the world will see it. It is the only way we have a chance that people might intervene.
Yeah, and if no one intervenes, it's still a good thing to show.
How can they not intervene when they witness such atrocities?
I think if people see this footage, they'll say, oh my God, that's horrible. And then go on eating their dinners.
Don Cheadle and Joaquin Phoenix in major roles in the new film Hotel Rwanda. Susan's calling from New York City. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw the film a couple of days ago. Mm. It's a brilliant film. And Paul is no ordinary human being, although I know the point you're trying to make. I thought the film was a damning unveiling of our national indifference in America. And it subtly and very deftly revealed the Clinton administration's proclivity to they spent their time discussing whether it was or not genocide instead of doing anything. And now, sadly, I think we're doing sort of the same thing in Dufour. It's a wonderful reminder. Those of us who lived through that time, and it wasn't very long ago.
No, it wasn't.
We're feeling that way, and our leadership failed us and as a nation, and of course the Rwandans. And I thought the film laid it out, and but not with a club.
Yeah, the reviews are terrific. Susan, as you watched that horror unfold in the film, did you find yourself in the kind of verisimilitude of watching, saying, where are the foreign forces? Where are the Americans? Where's the UN?
Well, of course, that was a question, but everybody played a brilliant role in recreating the situations, especially also the people who left the hotel, the white people, as the black people who were condemned to death, the Africans, held umbrellas over their head in the rain, leading them out to their bus that was going to bring them to safety.
Yeah.
I mean, these little touches were so magnificent, and it was that really wrenched my stomach.
The color of skin making all the difference between those who would fly out of there and those who would face whatever came.
Yes, and also the showing of the faces of the white people in the bus as they were leaving the bus, you know, there for a moment.
The kind of combination of guilt and relief there.
All had slightly different reactions, but the bottom line was they were going, and the people who were serving them were not going to.
Mm. Susan, thanks very much for your call. I'm glad you saw
the
film.
Thank you.
I'm glad you brought that to us. Let's hear a moment here with Nick Nolte and Don Cheadle, again playing Paul. Here's where Nick Nolte plays the UN official who's telling Paul, Don Cheadle, that the West doesn't really care about the Rwandans' plight.
Congratulations, Kenneth. You have performed a minor miracle.
Congratulations.
Yes, sir.
You should spit in my face.
Excuse me, Kenneth.
You're dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West. All the superpowers. Everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're done. You're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you are saying, sir.
Oh, come on. Me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel. Except for one thing. You're black. They're not gonna stay, Paul. They're not gonna stop the slaughter.
Nick Nolte and Don Cheadle in Hotel Rwanda. George is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Thanks. I haven't seen the film, and I probably won't go to see it. And part of the reason is that I think you have the same problem with this film as you did with Schindler's List and other efforts to depict the Holocaust on film and other forms of artistic expression, and that is the issue of trivialization. I mean, here you are talking about genocide. You're talking about it right here, even on this program. I mean, you're talking about it. You know, there's no real cost in talking about it. It's easy to talk about it. You talk about this the way an hour from now or maybe yesterday you talked about jazz or some other thing.
Well, I hope not. But if you don't talk about it, what's the profit in that, George?
That's the point here. There is, on the one hand, you have the problem of forgetting, which is bad. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have the problem of minimalization and trivialization, however well a film is done. And I'm just wondering if the director and the others who made this film have any feelings about that, if they feel this tension between, on the one hand, the problem of forgetting, on the other hand, the problem of trivialization.
George, stick with us. It's a good, very worthy question. Terry George, how about it? You must have felt it. I mean, I have to say, from the bit I've seen, there's a very somber, elegiac tone here. But even so, you just put it on the screen, and George is right. It's playing next to, you know, every other sort of lightweight film in the theater. And yet, if you don't make it, you don't make it. You don't tell the story.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's always the dilemma with artists. I'm quite sure that Guernica, Picasso's masterpiece dealing with the slaughter of the Basques by the Nazis is beside one of his lesser films in that museum.
Or portraits.
But, you know, what other way have artists got to express themselves in their rage? And I have to say that the medium of film is, like it or not, the medium most the mass medium of today, and in order to convey what went on in Rwanda, to carry the message that I listened to people in Rwanda and Kigali tell me, to reconvey to them the mass graves that I saw in places like Narabuye, the skeletons and the corpses I saw in Murambi, to try to get across to the world the enormity of what happened. I feel is an artist's obligation, and using the medium of film, I think that people's point of reference of the Cambodian genocide is the film The Killing Fields. For many people, the reference to the Holocaust is Schindler's List, and to raise their awareness is not to trivialize that event. Far from it. It's to try and engage people to understand in a unique way what took place, and to understand it through one person's eyes. So the whole thing of putting your head in the sand and saying, oh, you're only going to trivialize this by doing anything about it. How can we possibly pass on to our children the ability to understand what took place unless we use the artistic medium to do that?
George, what do you say to that? What is the alternative?
I know. And you express it very well. And yet, this has been going on for some time. And we have had films about the Holocaust, and we have films, including your own, about the Killing Fields. And yet, we allow these things to continue. And their sensitivity has not been heightened.
But George, let me give you one illustration of the power of film. I wrote the film In the Name of the Father with Jim Sheridan, right? We wrote it in 1993, made it in 1994. After that film was released, people in the State Department and the White House told me that there were members of the Clinton administration who were unfamiliar with Northern Ireland, who watched that film and whose interest was triggered. Subsequently, Bill Clinton's administration pushed through a peace process that has brought about peace in Northern Ireland. Now, I'm not saying In the Name of the Father was the instigator or the motivator of that, but I am saying that it was a spark, that created a spark that allowed people to understand the situation and to become involved in it. And I do think that with Hotel Rwanda, we have a way of informing people not just of history, not just of what has been taking place in the past, but also Paul and I have traveled the country and said, this is going on in Darfur today. Mm. It's going on in the Congo. We have to. If you feel anything from this film as you leave, you have got to do something about it. We've set up a fund, the UN Fund for Rwanda, that's available, that people can investigate on our website, hotelrwanda.com, and I have gone to the State Department and showed this film. I have sat with the people who make policy and said to them, what are we going to do? I've gone to the UN and screened it there twice. I've screened it at the Holocaust Museum. This is not, for me, a money-making exercise, and for Paul, it's a clarion call not to let this happen again, not to abuse Africa, not to exploit it the way we have. And I don't know any other medium that can reach ordinary people in the same way that film can.
But, George, you raise a tough question and a good one. We live in the information age, and yet to tap into that and not trivialize, I have to say, from what I've seen, I have not been able to see it all yet. It hasn't opened in Boston, but this looks like a noble effort. George, thanks for your call. Terry George, Paul Rusesabagina, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the new film, Hotel Rwanda, about Rwanda's last sanctuary in the genocide of 1994. You can join this conversation with genocide officially underway right now in Darfur. What have we learned from Rwanda? And can you imagine being in Paul Rusesabagina's shoes? Could you have been that strong, that resourceful in the face of genocide? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are checking into Hotel Rwanda tonight, the new film on Rwanda's last sanctuary in the genocide of 1994. I'm joined by the director, writer, and producer of Hotel Rwanda, Terry George, and by Paul Rusesabagina, the hotelier who saved the lives of more than 1,200 Rwandans and others during the 100 days of killing in Rwanda a decade ago. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine being in his shoes? Could you have been that strong? And what's the hotel, what's the country we should be at work in right now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Annika's calling from Jersey City, New Jersey. Hi, Annika. You're on the air.
Hello. I intend to see the film. I'm so impressed about what I hear. Can this film be used to raise money for Darfur? You may have answered it while I was holding on, but I would like to know, can this film be used to raise money for Darfur?
Annika, we've got it, and we'll pick it up. Terry George, you were saying at your website that there's word on how to make contributions around the Rwandan case.
Yeah,
what about the question?
Yeah, and also we have links. We've linked our website to several groups that are raising money for Darfur for Rwanda. We've linked to Amnesty International because we feel the film, like we said, is a clarion call. And it's a very good question because there's something I wanted to say tonight, Paul,
please,
that's particularly important. We've witnessed in the last 10 days probably the greatest natural disaster we will ever see in our lifetimes. I hope it's the biggest and most horrendous we will ever see.
In the tsunami.
In the tsunami in Southeast Asia. Mm. Now, and there's been a groundswell of giving and donations from the public that has been commendable, and I'm proud to see that people both here in the United States and across Europe have done that. But what this natural catastrophe has the possibility to do is create a second tsunami, which is to wash over the human disasters in Africa and make them disappear from public view. The situation in Darfur has disappeared off the front pages.
In spite of the fact that it goes on.
Not only will it go on, but this is the sort of event that the Janjaweed will use, that once it disappears from the front pages, they will use the disappearance from the front pages to finish the job.
The killing
militia. To finish
militia
the job
there,
that they started, mm-hmm, to wipe out the African population of Darfur and Sudan. And we can't allow that to happen. We can't allow the situation in the Congo to disappear. And I think it's easier for all of our governments to say, we're going to pour money into Southeast Asia and we're going to rebuild. That's a question of money and construction and feeding people. When it comes to Africa, there's a human dilemma. There's a political issue that has to be resolved. There's a willpower that's needed to be applied that wasn't applied in Rwanda. And I'm not saying don't give to the tsunami relief, but please, please do not forget the African continent.
Paul Rusesabagina, you've now traveled, seen a lot of how Americans are responding, seen this movie come together. You were there in the heart of that situation in Kigali. How does it leave you feeling? Do you feel cynical about... I mean, here, a wonderful director like Terry George in Hollywood, one way and another, can put together what by all reviews is quite a terrific film, and yet there was not an intervention in Rwanda, and there is not an intervention in Darfur. How does that leave you feeling?
Well, this led me as thought that African life has got not the same value as the European value, because there was a genocide in Bosnia and also Yugoslavia, and the West intervened. The West was there to solve the problems. But when it comes to Africa, nobody cares. Even the media forget completely what is going on in Africa. You know, in Burundi, people have been killed for the last almost 40 years.
Also with Hutu-Tutsi conflict there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, the same Hutu-Tutsi business. And the whole world had turned its back and closed its eyes to the African, the Great Lakes region problems. And this has been going on in Congo, where more than 3.5 million people have been butchered, and nobody can even talk about it. In Rwanda, it has happened, and the world turned completely its back, and they came to evacuate their own citizens.
Mm, Paula,
and we were abandoned and left on our own.
Let me ask you, you've said that during the genocide, quoting you here, teachers killed their pupils, wives killed their husbands, and husbands killed their wives, parents killed their own children, priests killed. It was just a kind of madness, an unbelievable horror. After a decade, you look back on it, you have the Hutu-Tutsi combination within your own marriage. How do you understand what happened in Rwanda? How could this happen? We know there was no intervention, but on the part of Rwandans themselves, why? How?
There are many problems which have been a cause of that, what happened in Rwanda, for instance. In Rwanda, it is first of all because of a bad leadership using the media, misusing the media. This has been the problem in Rwanda. In 1993, the former government, the president himself with his Hutu hardliners, extremists, they found a radio called Radio Television de Mikolin, RTLM.
Yeah.
And that tool was misused to dehumanize Tutsis calling them cockroaches. So killing an insect, killing a cockroach is not a sin. So there was no punishment. There's no judgment. Whoever was killing another person, it was enough to call him a cockroach, and that could be that.
And
what's
that,
any punishment?
Once that dehumanization really sets in, anything can happen. I hate to say it, but we're out of time. It's been terrific talking with both of you, and I must say congratulations on putting the film together. Terry George, director, writer, and producer of Hotel Rwanda. Paul Rusesa Bagina, wonderful to have you with us tonight. I'll never forget those months after the slaughter in Rwanda, watching people greet one another on the streets in a total astonishment that they were alive, each other alive. Just everyone was dead. To see each other alive was like a miracle. Thanks for reminding us. In a moment, President Bush proposes sweeping new medical malpractice reform. This is On Point. President Bush made his first trip out of Washington of the new year today to push a second-term domestic policy priority, curbing medical malpractice lawsuits. The president took his message to Madison County, Illinois, a place that tort reform advocates have dubbed a judicial hellhole because of its long record of big-money, plaintiff-friendly decisions. In his speech, President Bush called for a $250,000 cap on non-economic damages, such as for pain and suffering, and argued that what he called frivolous lawsuits hurt everyone, including patients.
What's happening all across this country is that lawyers are filing baseless suits against hospitals and doctors. That's just a plain fact. And they're doing it for a simple reason. They know the medical liability system is tilted in their favor. Jury awards in medical liability cases have skyrocketed in recent years. That means every claim filed by a personal injury lawyer brings the chance of a huge payoff. And because the system is so unpredictable, there is a constant risk of being hit by a massive jury award. So doctors end up paying tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars to settle claims out of court, even when they know they have done nothing wrong. That's what's happening in the system today. It's a system that's just not fair. It's costly for the doctors. It's costly for small businesses. It's costly for hospitals. It is really costly for patients.
President Bush speaking earlier today in Collinsville, Illinois. NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner joins me now. Julie, thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to be here.
So there's the president making his case. What do the odds appear to be that President Bush can push through this very tough $250,000 cap on non-economic damages on medical malpractice?
Well, I guess the odds are a little bit better than they were last year, but not remarkably better. The House, of course, has passed this bill eight or nine times since 1995, mm-hmm. long predating President Bush's ascension. The Senate has never passed. The Senate actually took it up last year several times in different, slightly different iterations. The closest it got was a vote of 49 to 48. Now, the arithmetic that I've done over the last couple of days, looking at the new senators and the senators that have departed, I think that those on President Bush's side have picked up about three votes, which brings them to 52. Well, of course, in the Senate, you really need 60 votes to break a filibuster that certainly would occur over this bill. And obviously, 52 is a long way from 60.
What's the critical margin of resistance in the Senate? And maybe I should say who?
Well, it's mostly the Democrats versus the Republicans. And obviously for the president, this is wonderful Republican politics. This is businesses who are in favor of this and doctors and hospitals and, you know, longtime Republican allies. And against it are primarily trial lawyers. And trial lawyers, as most people know, tend to give to Democrats. It's one of Democrats' most important campaign finance, sources of campaign finance. So basically he gets the president gets to sort of please his friends and irritate his enemies by pushing this. So you have Democrats pretty much united against it. You also have several Republican trial lawyers, people like Senator Lindsey Graham, very conservative Republican from South Carolina, who hates this bill and who constantly votes against it.
And what does Lindsey Graham, a Republican, and Democrats who oppose it, what's their line of defense of tort law as it stands?
Well, certainly they say one of the arguments against this particular iteration, which is capping non-economic damages, is that by definition you're not stopping frivolous lawsuits. You're hurting the people who have proved their case. They don't get damages unless they've proved their case.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly one of the defenses. I
want to be sure I understand that, Julie. You're saying they've proved their case and then it's moved on to the non-economic, to the pain and suffering. So the core damage has already been proven. And the president's saying, let's just not pay out more than $250,000 for the suffering that incurred from proven damage.
That's right. That's the argument. It's a little bit convoluted. The argument in favor of the $250,000 cap is based on a California law that was passed in 1974. And basically the argument goes that if we cap non-economic damages, the pain and suffering damages, the ones that tend to be very high, and I'll come back to that in a second, then we will keep medical malpractice premiums lower. That's the argument we've got. We have these caps in a lot of states. There's a lot of different interpretations of how well they've worked. But basically, one thing that everybody seems to agree on is that they may hold down malpractice premium increases in the future, but they won't actually lower them. If a state were to pass a cap, it's not going to lower somebody's premium. It may keep the premium from going up very much faster. Now, I've seen other studies that say that one of the reasons jury awards are going up is not because people are getting dramatic non-economic damages. It's because their economic damages are going up, because their medical, the future medical bills, to take care of these injuries is going up, and that's something that this bill wouldn't address. So I think everybody agrees that the malpractice system doesn't work very well. The president is right on that point. It's people who are injured tend not to get compensated. People who get compensated are not always the ones who are most severely injured. There's simply an argument about whether this is the best solution to address that problem.
And what about the political calculus here? If it should come to it, and the Democrats are filibustering this in the Senate, is that a winning proposition for them? If it's holding up every other piece of business that might be addressed, are the Democrats going to come out politically as winners here as they defend what might be look like trial lawyer interest to the rest of the country, or much of it?
It's not just there. All the consumer groups are with the trial lawyers on this. So these are traditional Democratic constituencies. I don't think it's going to come to that. It's hard to imagine the Republicans putting this up on the floor and making the Democrats really physically filibustered. I think it's more likely what happened last year, where they kept bringing it up, having the vote, losing the vote, and Senator Frist vowed to bring it up every couple of months. He kept wanting to make the Democrats vote against it. But I don't know that this is an issue that really moves the public a whole lot.
But President Bush putting it very high on his agenda, very prominent at the beginning of the year here.
Yes, indeed. It is an issue that is important to the president. Of course, he doesn't have a lot of health issues, so this is a health issue. And he likes to say that it will really, you know, bring down the cost of health care. That is certainly debatable. The Congressional Budget Office says that it would be more like a 0.5% difference.
Well, he must feel like it's working for him. Julie Robner, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Julie Robner is health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.